This episode of The Orb is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for your desktop or mobile device. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. Also, help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day by becoming a Trek FM patron through Patreon. Get access to exclusive content and become part of the team. You'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
This is J.G. Hertz, the General Martok on Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome, Niners, to another episode of The Orb, our dedicated Deep Space Nine show. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me, as he is every show, is my esteemed co-host, Matthew Rushing. Matthew, what's that book on your desk there? How to Pick Up Solids? What is that?
Chris, you weren't supposed to see that. Hold on, let me just move that down. Yeah.
Did Odo loan that to you?
Yeah, he did. He did. He was trying to ask me. I mean, obviously, because I'm a married man, he wanted to make sure that the advice in the book was actually solid. And so, he just wanted to make sure that it was actually going to get him somewhere, and then now I don't know if he even wants it back because, I mean, he's a changeling again, so...
Yeah, he has a lot more options now.
It's very true.
His situation is very fluid, Matthew.
It is. I was just about to make a fluid joke.
We got a solid joke and a fluid joke in there, all right.
Oh, man. We're just slipping and sliding all over the place here.
That's what we do here on The Orb. All right. Well, today we're going to talk about In Purgatory's Shadow. It's going to be the first of a two-part series here for us, talking about this episode as well as By Inferno's Light, which comes after. And we decided to do this because recently we did our commentary on Defiant. And Matthew, as you pointed out in that episode, the whole fleet buildup that the Obsidian Order is trying to hide is tied into the story in the sense that that's the fleet that invades the Gamma Quadrant. And then here, the Dominion is coming back through to the Alpha Quadrant. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's the possibility that some survivors from that original attack might be over there. That's some of the justification that Garrick gives for getting the runabout so he can go look for Tane. And also in this episode, of course, we see the very interesting twist that stems from that in a way of, well, if the Cardassians are going to attack us, well, let's just make them part of the Dominion.
Yeah. I wonder, that's something that never really gets completely answered. And I'd love to see a novel actually written, especially like I'd say by Una McCormick, going back and telling the story of Dukat winning the Dominion over. And yeah. Just why they chose to align with the Cardassians. Was it because they, you know, from their time in the Alpha Quadrant with their plants, they have their different changeling infiltrators, they realized that was the best option for them. Like, they were the most dupable, basically, because, you know, you would think that, the Cardassians, with everything that's happened, the war between them and the Klingons, that somebody like the Romulans are in a much stronger position, but maybe through their clandestine activities, they've realized that really the Cardassians aren't the best choice, but they're really the only choice they have to make this work.
Well, I can see a couple of things here, and I think that if you're looking for strength in terms of a military power to align yourself with, yeah, the Romulans make more sense. But from the Dominion perspective, they probably don't feel that they really need assistance in terms of firepower of military. What they need is territory and access to the Alpha Quadrant. They need an area of space that they can control that is within proximity to the enemies they're going to fight. And since Dukat has reached out to them, then that's their opportunity to get access to that. And I was thinking here, watching this episode, and of course we also watched By Inferno's Light as part of preparing for this, so we might have a little bit of crossover here. We might mention some things that happened there. But the fact that they're going to send a fleet through the wormhole and go to Cardassian space is, it's really their prerogative, and it's the prerogative of the Cardassians if they want to be part of the Dominion. And the Federation really doesn't have any say in that, except for the fact that the Federation controls the wormhole, and therefore they have to pass through Federation space. It's, technically, it's not Federation space.
Yeah, it's more like a protectorate, almost. You know, like,
yeah, like a protectorate area. But they have to pass through space that's controlled by the Federation or protected by the Federation in order to get to Cardassia. So it's sort of like, you know, you have these odd situations here and there on the planet, like in Russia, for example, where you have this little bit of Russia that's not connected to the rest of Russia. And you'd have to pass through other territory to get there. So it's kind of like that situation. But at the end of the day, to address what you're asking here, I think that they just need a foothold, and it doesn't really matter to them that much who that is.
Well, and I think, I guess I was thinking as we were talking, and it kind of came to me, okay, of course they would choose them. They would choose the Cardassians because the Cardassians are the ones that are willing, and they're the ones closest to the wormhole in the Alpha Quadrant. And I'm pretty sure the Dominion...
And they probably see Dukat as easy to manipulate.
Right, exactly. And I think they see that, you know, what's next to the wormhole? One space station that's controlled by the Federation and the and Bajorans together, and Bajoran space, and the Bajorans aren't, you know, a part of the Federation, and therefore, I think they think, and it will come to pass, that it will be easy to drive the Federation back from the wormhole area there in the Bajoran system. So, I think that it's really interesting. I just would love to see that play out in a book, though, the negotiations, and get the founders. I guess I'd really want the founders' side to that. So, you know, it's
a founding perspective.
Exactly, exactly. So, what foundation are they building on? You know, Chris.
exactly. I wonder.
So.
All right. So that's an interesting setup, just what's going on in the story arc in order for the Dominion to get over into the Alpha Quadrant and the big transition. I mean, Dukat, he's all over the place. He's got a bird of prey. He's got a Klingon bird of prey of his own. Now he's joining the Dominion. You just never know what he's going to do.
Well, you know, it's really interesting because even if you haven't seen the second episode, and of course, watching retrospectively now, it all flows together. But this first episode here, in Purgatory Shadow, Dukat seems kind of fishy. You start to pick up the clues of what he's kind of laying down. And in fact, you know, when he's really upset about, you know, his daughter and Garrick, and then the way that he threatens Major Kira, and all of that, it really comes off as a guy who feels like he has a lot more power behind him than he actually does. So he plays it so
well. Yeah, he has some reason, to pound his chest, right? Speaking of Kira, I love how tough she is and how she stands up to anyone, but especially Dukat. He's threatening her, and she's just like, if that's a threat, I'm not impressed.
Yeah.
You know, that's it.
That is one of the best scenes that they play together, I think, ever. Because you can tell when he leaves, she kind of gives like a sigh of like, okay, I made it, you know. But that was not like easy for her to do, to put on the I don't care air.
Well, you see that from Kira throughout the series, where she's very tough in standing up to people. it's not always that she's not concerned or frazzled about it, but she's so good at putting on that tough face.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. then she can sigh after,
yes.
but she doesn't let anyone yes. intimidate her.
Well, and quickly before we leave Kira, I just have to mention what I really love is the way this episode starts with that quiet moment between her and Odo when they're moving yeah. into his quarters and what we were making fun of at the beginning. I love how uncomfortable Odo is talking about this idea of a solid relationship because it's her he wants that relationship with. And
right,
he's like,
right.
he's doing everything he can. Can we just stop this conversation, please?
Well, she said, I'm sure there are plenty of women on the station that would be interested
yeah.
in you.
He's like, I don't want plenty. I just want you.
Okay, let's go back to what you just mentioned a moment ago and talk about Dukat and Zial in this episode, because we've talked a lot here on The Orb about that relationship, and we've tried to figure out whether Dukat actually cares about Zial at all, or if she's just a means to an end for him. And in this episode, as a father, I actually see what I think is genuine concern for his daughter. Now, of course, he doesn't like Garrick, and we know he doesn't like Garrick. And if she were sitting there with some other Cardassian, he probably wouldn't get so upset. But it does feel like he genuinely wants to protect his daughter from this particular man because he believes that this man is a very bad person. And that part feels genuine to me. And I would say that in most of this episode, it feels pretty genuine that there's this father-daughter relationship. Now, in the next episode, towards the end, I start to feel differently about it. But how do you see the events of this episode playing into your overall view of Dukat and his relationship with Zial?
To me, I feel like this episode and the next episode, that they reinforce the fact that, for me, I don't think he really cares. And why I come to that is because at the moment that she doesn't do what he wants, I mean, she's an adult now, so,
yeah.
you know, but the moment that she doesn't do what he wants, he immediately disowns her and leaves her to a place where she's going to be blown up. At least that's the plan. And he doesn't
it's
care.
It's true that, but we don't know yet. This is the thing in this episode, right. and this is where it bleeds together. We don't know yet that he already has this plan of joining the Dominion and retaking the station. And the other thing here too is that, and boy, these do run together. We don't know if Dukat knew anything about the changeling plan to blow up the Bajoran sun.
That's a good point, but I don't know. I guess it really, to me, the pattern plays out that he plays nice with her as she kind of plays the part that he wants her to play. The yeah. moment she's not playing the part or the way he sees it, he disowns her and it or leaves her somewhere to die.
Yeah, and, that's true.
So,
yeah.
you know, to me, that's not real love or real care. To me, that's kind of, to use a Star Wars example, that's Anakin with Padme. You know, it's, I don't know if obsessive love is really love, because it's, I think it's more about possession.
Yeah,
and for
yeah.
Dukat, she's a possession of his, not really a relationship of his. And
yeah.
like well, a possession, you know, you put your action figures on the table or whatever in your house, you know, they don't move, you know.
Well, I'll tell you one thing. I've got one of Picard right over there. And when he doesn't do what I want, I put him in the box and I put it in the cabinet.
Straighten your shirt, Picard.
I cannot see you anymore, Picard. You are dead to me. No, but what you're saying, yeah, I think what you're saying is true. I think it's very complicated with him. Like, mm-hmm. I do think that yeah. there is some amount of genuine concern and care and love for his daughter, but it's not an unconditional love. It's mm-hmm. not.
It's very possessive.
He doesn't necessarily
possessive.
Want what's best for her all the time. He wants what's best for her if it also fits into his plans.
Yeah. I just don't know. I don't really know if we have verbiage to necessarily explain his relationship with his
we
daughter.
We would need to speak Cardassian, Matthew.
I guess.
To have all the necessary words.
Yeah. They have like 30 different words for daughter. And so, no, I just, to me, the relationship seems one based on do what I want and I'll quote unquote love you. And I'm putting that in air quotes. Don't do what I want and I won't love you. So it's a merit based system. And that's, again, that's not love. That's not love at all.
Yeah.
So I have a really hard time calling it love or care or anything else. I don't really know what to call it other than kind of like having a puppy almost. If the puppy does bad, you know, some people will smack it on the nose, you know, and that's kind of how I feel like he treats his daughter, sadly, like a pet he mistreats.
Yeah. Yeah, I can see that too. Well, we'll talk more about this in the next episode because some of the events change my view on it a little bit. I'm trying to keep things focused on In Purgatory Shadow here, which is a little bit tough. Related to this, let's talk about Garrick and Zial a little bit. What do you make of Zial's love for Garrick?
I think one of the cool things, and for me, what I see in this episode is really the beginning of her bringing something out in Garrick that he doesn't really know is there.
Yeah.
Like, she is, I think, part of a redemption for Garrick. She's a part of his redemption story. And I think her goodness, her kindness, her seeing something in Garrick that nobody else has seen or has ever wanted to see does something. I mean, because when everybody sees you as a spy, a saboteur, and a liar, you live up to that potential. But what
you have to practice at it every
right,
day.
Right, exactly.
Matthew.
Exactly. You do.
It's an art.
It is an art, that's for sure. And Garrick's very good at it. But Zial does see him differently. She sees a goodness in him that nobody else sees. And I think she actually draws that out of him. And I love their relationship here. It's, I don't know, for myself personally, you know, having been in some relationships with people who are a bit younger than I am, it is an interesting thing because there is a naivety to somebody that's that young compared to him. You know, you get the feeling like Garrick's probably in his late 30s and she is probably 20.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
So there's quite a bit of an age difference, but I think that she's able to actually teach him something about the world and something about the universe that he's never experienced, which is unconditional love. Because that's obviously not what he got from Tane. Tane loves, yeah. quote unquote, loves Garrick like, almost like Dukat loves Zial. You know, it seems like, to me, for Cardassians, with their parents, there's a big merit-based system on whether they're accepted or not.
Well, Tane tells Garrick in the next episode that he was always a weakness
mm-hmm. yes.
that he couldn't afford, right? And I think that it's the same for Dukat. He sees Zial as a weakness because she's half Bajoran.
Yeah, that's and maybe that is why they work so well together, because they're able to give each other something that neither of them has ever had from anybody else of their species, you
yeah.
know? And they are able to, I think, well, the wonderful thing about Zial is she just has it in spades. You know, I mean, she's been mistreated her entire life by her parents and yet has turned out to be this beautiful, amazing person. Part of that's probably Kira taking care of her for so long now.
Yeah.
But she's still not a character, a person who has turned to hate and anger and rage for all the things that have happened to her. And, you know, I think that's attractive to Garrick. So I really love their friendship, relationship, whatever it is, this kind of flirtation that they have. And I think she truly does love him. I don't think Garrick will ever say that to her. I don't think he ever actually says that to her in the series.
No, I don't think he ever actually says it, but...
No, I think he alludes to the fact that he did after she died, but he never tells her, so...
Yeah, I'm not sure that she ever really knows how he feels, but she certainly makes it clear to him how she feels. And in this episode, when they're talking, she actually asks him why he always makes fun of her feelings for him, and he says that he thinks they are misplaced. And in the next episode, I think it becomes very clear why he reacts the way that he does to her when she expresses feelings for him. But even leading up to this point, everything that we know about Garrick and the conversation even that he has with Worf in the runabout about wanting to join Starfleet, and then talking about how you must always practice to lie, I think that, you know, he knows that his entire life is this giant facade, and that maybe he thinks that if she looks at me and she loves me based on what she sees, it's misplaced because everything that I do is some kind of lie, or it's some way of diverting people. That's just what Garrick does.
I think that's one of the things that's really interesting, because if you watch from this point on, I think this is where Garrick's life becomes less and less of a lie and more and more of the truth each and every time you see him. And by the time you end the series, Garrick has become somebody, it's almost like in the Chris Nolan Batman series, Batman's always been in the shadows, he's always been in the dark, but at the very end of The Dark Knight Rises, Batman is on the streets of Gotham in the daylight, in his, you know, costume, fighting with everybody else in the city. He's in the light, finally, and I feel like that kind of happens to Garrick. Like, he's always been in the shadows, he's always been this kind of liar, and yet, as the series moves forward, he continually becomes less and less of that, and more of somebody who, what you see is what you get. Now, not completely, because he's still Garrick, but I think a big part of that is his relationship with the Zial, and his relationship with Bashir, and his relationship that he forges with even people like Sisko and all of the other officers and Bajoran officers that he works with all the time. So it's an amazing storyline. Garrick's storyline is really hands down one of the best in Star Trek of all time. And crazy to think that he's only in 20 some odd episodes.
Yeah, it is amazing. So before we move on, while we're still in this little area of the story here, did you notice Kira's nice little TOS reference? She tells Dukat, "You go on fighting your private little war."
Oh, yes, yes, yes. That was...
I don't know if that was actually put in there as a TOS reference or not, but knowing the writers, it probably was. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was pretty
What
cool.
did you think about just the fact that, you know, so Worf and Garrick go off, and they're in the Gamma Quadrant, and we realize there's this huge buildup of ships, and then they're taken to this internment camp. I remember, for me, because when this episode came out, that internment camp and everything, I just thought it was the coolest thing, because they didn't do a lot of this type of stuff on Star Trek where they gave you a CGI type of background. And to me, this was one of the coolest things that they ever did on Deep Space Nine. It was just so... Star Trek, you know, like we're on an asteroid that, I mean, it kind of felt Star Warsy almost, but at the same time, it was really awesome. This whole storyline, it was like Deep Space Nine was just cranking it up a notch.
Yeah. They don't do that very often, right? There was that one episode on Voyager, the shoot, where they're in this prison that's either an asteroid or it's just some kind of like little ship, you know, that's floating out there and you can't get off. But it was... I remember in first run thinking, like, wow, this is kind of different. We haven't seen anything like this before. And it really ramps up the danger, because you're wondering, how are they going to get out of this? Except luckily, for some reason, the Jem'Hadar have decided to leave the runabout parked right outside of the prison asteroid. Why don't you destroy the ship or haul it back somewhere and take it apart for the technology?
No, you always leave the getaway car parked where the enemy left it. So that's, exactly. I mean, it's just, that's what you do.
That's the one, like, big loophole in this, in the writing of this episode, of this two-parter, that just doesn't make any sense.
It kind of doesn't make sense, but at the same time, I always think to myself, they would never think that there was any way for them to contact this runabout. You know, like, to them, this is their maximum security prison. This is where you throw the worst of the worst of the worst. They're never seen from again. There's nowhere for them to go. Yeah. And so, to me, I know it is a stupid plot contrivance, but at the same time, you know, have we ever seen the Jem'Hadar to really be one's first strategy? You know, I mean,
yeah, but it's sort of the, you know, that's always the fatal mistake, right? Well, there's no way they're going to get back over there. So it's kind of a cliche of writing.
It's the classic, like, Bond bad guy mistake.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, I mean, it's fine, but I think what would have been more interesting here, well, you know what, I'm going to save this thought for the next show because it's about the escape and I don't want to jump too far ahead, but there's a different way I would have handled this probably. Okay, sticking with this episode and talking about Worf and Garak going over there, the conversation that they have about Garak wanting to join Starfleet and maybe he could just skip the lower ranks and just start off as a commander, and how would you feel about working for me? Worf has, like, the greatest self-control, doesn't he? Because before they got on the ship and he told Sisko that at the first sign of betrayal, I will kill him. Sisko says, I assume that's a joke. We'll see.
Yeah, that's the best line. I love it.
But I noticed on Memory Alpha, whoever wrote the summary for this episode, I think they kind of missed Sisko's point because they wrote something like, Sisko assumes that it's a joke, but Worf says we'll see. I don't think Sisko assumes it's a joke at all. I think Sisko knows that Worf is serious, and that's his way of warning him. You're a Starfleet officer. That's not acceptable.
I am a complete agreement with you because I don't think Worf's kidding. I think that if Worf came back with Garak's head and that was it, he'd feel like that was okay.
Yeah.
You know, like, I think it makes sense that Worf is on his toes because he knows who Garak is in life.
Yeah.
And
he doesn't trust Garak at all.
No, not at all. And, I mean, Garak even gives him reasons for not trusting him. He's practicing his lying. He almost has Worf until he says, maybe I could just skip the... I mean, that's his way of letting Worf in on the joke, you know?
Yeah.
So it's a great dynamic with those two because it's the completely opposite buddy cop type of movie vibe that you get from them. And to put them in this situation together where, yes, they're going to have to try and escape, and we can talk about that later, but I love their interplay here because the deadpan of Michael Dorn is awesome. It's perfect.
He's so good at it,
He's
right?
He's awesome.
He really is. While we're on the topic of Worf, we do need to roll back a little bit and talk about Worf and Jadzia when Worf is going. I think it's so funny that Worf doesn't want to tell Jadzia that he's going on this mission because he knows that she's not going to be happy about it. But the funnier thing is that she wants his Klingon operas and he's so worried about those. And we were talking on the other side of the orb about that scene. And I actually had in my notes, can't he just stream them from Space Kronos Music, you know, the lossless clack
they
format?
They don't have Space Spotify? I mean, what?
I know, it's like, I think it's so fun. It just shows how Star Trek is very forward-looking. And I was actually talking about this at the office yesterday with some of my colleagues. We were talking about pads. And Star Trek was very forward-looking technologically in many ways, but there are a lot of things that they just couldn't foresee. So with the pad, they could foresee a flat device that displays information, but not a flat device that can display any kind of information you want, and you can just change it whenever. Therefore, you've got to have 30 pads on your desk if you're researching something.
Yeah, no such thing as apps.
Right? And the same thing here with these isolinear rods and the music. Yeah, they're a different shape than a CD, but basically they're space CDs, right? If you lose them or you damage them, they don't play anymore and you can't get new copies.
And I mean, if you're with a partner that misplaces things easily, you know, it rolls under the couch, you may not find it for months.
Well, and who knows, you know, Jadzia could have like some of those fire jugglers over in her quarters while Worf's away, and they might burn the rods by accident. You never know what's going to happen in Jadzia's quarters.
That is so true. I love their interplay, though. It's what's so wonderful about it is that, you know, from the moment that they met on screen in the way of the warrior, they've had such a wonderful chemistry, and the writers give them such incredible things to play with, and the scenes that are so about their character. You know, the way in which Jadzia is going to make a scene if Worf tells her, probably in ops, because she's not happy that he's going, and the way in which he's worried that what he's really most worried about, not that he's not going to come back, but she is going to lose his precious Klingon operas, to which apparently cannot be replaced. I guess maybe it would be like having the original, you know, White Album on vinyl or something. I don't know.
Yeah, I guess so. Well, maybe what happens is that maybe he can sync them with Kronos Music, but Kronos Music would replace those live opera recordings with studio tracks. And just screw up his collection.
Yeah, kind of like how, you know, Apple iTunes Match doesn't always get the song quite right. If you had the, you know, the explicit version, it might give you the clean version when you stream it. So,
exactly. Yeah,
he doesn't want his explicit operas toned down.
Well, I'm pretty sure that Klingon opera is very explicit, Matthew.
I'm sure it is. I'm sure it is. Very violent.
And glorious.
Well, that's true. I mean, that's a given, Chris.
Yeah, exactly. All right. This part's going to be a little difficult to talk about here because we don't find out until the next episode that Bashir has been replaced with a changeling. But knowing that, when you watch Bashir's actions in this episode, knowing that he is a changeling, do you pick up on anything that sort of makes you wonder, there's something odd about him, or is it just played straight?
Yeah, it is interesting because, I mean, that last act, you know, they bring in Bashir.
Oh, so the very end of this episode.
Yes, it's the very end of this episode. So you're very tail end. Yeah, it's the very, very end.
It all runs together.
Yeah, and it's interesting because, yes, when you do go back and you rewatch it, I think it is really interesting because you can see the areas in which the changeling Bashir is maybe asking some questions that the normal Bashir wouldn't about things. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, so I like the way that Alexander Siddig plays the part as the changeling because you can actually see the difference. And then anytime that he's just alone, he's playing it much more alien. And so he's doing really, really well. And I think it's a great, wonderful use of changeling infiltrators. And I think it makes a lot of sense for the show. And I'm glad they went there because in Star Trek, you can make this work. And I think they pull this one off pretty masterfully.
Yeah, it's just so interesting. It's kind of like we've talked about before. When you go back and you watch DS9 from season one forward, knowing that Bashir is genetically enhanced. Now, at that point, Alexander Siddig isn't doing anything special like, hey, I'm genetically enhanced, but I'm hiding it.
Right.
But it's interesting to see when he does certain things and then in your head canon, they can kind of make a little bit more sense with that knowledge. And here you have that plus the fact that he knows from the script that he is a changeling. And therefore, he puts that little nuance in. And it's fun to watch it back, because in first run, you didn't know until the very end of the episode what was going on. And then you start thinking, well, the episode before this and the episode before this, he was a changeling.
Yep.
What's been going on? Right?
That's where you have to start doing the math with, you know, the star dates to see which episode it is that he left, you know, and where it becomes. And did he know, or was this just something that the writers ended up springing on him? And
I think it's the latter. Yeah.
Yeah, it probably is, but it still works, you know? I mean, so, and I got to say, this changeling infiltrator doing a great job. So just as good of a job, apparently, as the Martok changeling infiltrator did.
Very nice job. In fact, I was picturing a changeling language school where they go to school all day and they really practice their accents and they practice their inflections so that they can just get the person that they're replacing down to a T, because this changeling is great. And he should be, because he's being played by Alexander Siddig. But he's great at doing the Bashir accent and getting all of the speech patterns and inflections of Bashir just right.
And it makes me wonder, do they have like recordings of Bashir so that the changeling could watch and to mimic and to learn all of that kind of... I mean, do they must have access to copious amounts of information so that he can recall all of the things that... I mean... He's been there for 4 weeks, and apparently his best friend doesn't realize he's not him.
Yeah.
You know, so he's knowing all the inside jokes and everything like that, too. So this is really creepy when you start to think about how good these changeling infiltrators are, and that if this hadn't happened, you know, they hadn't have gone, they hadn't gotten interned, and then they hadn't escaped, nobody would know.
Yeah. Well, it's either that... Or it's the NSA, the Not Solid Security Agency. Or, this is what I thought also, what if they had a changeling on the station for a really long, extended period of time observing Bashir, and they do that when they're going to replace somebody, and no one knows. They just, you know, they lie low, they're never detected. Because you really, really would have to have, like you said, either copious amounts of information, or you would have to observe someone for... a really long time in order to pull something off so believably.
Well, I mean, you know, when you can be a chair or the wall, yeah, you can observe somebody all the time and they would never know. So, yeah, it's pretty scary.
Well, Matthew, we talked mostly about character moments in this episode, and the real action really heats up in the next one. So we're going to wrap up part one here, and then next time we're going to talk about the Celestial Temple and the wormhole and the fleets and Dukat's betrayal and what's happening fighting the Jem'Hadar, as well as why you should never turn your back on a Breen.
Which, Chris... Isn't that just amazing writing for what's going to happen with the Breen later on? Never turn your back on the Breen. Would they turn their back on the entire galaxy for the Dominion? It's just awesome.
Exactly. Well, I like the fact that you've got this one character just sitting in the corner the whole time. It's like this.
Poor, it's a race that can't talk. Whoever was in that thing the whole time, can you imagine the actor? Like he's getting paid very little because he's not. There's no lines for them. So it's...
Oh, man. All right. So that's all for this episode. But Deep Space Nine isn't the only thing we've been talking about here on the network recently. So here's a quick look at some other things you may have missed elsewhere on Trek FM.
Previously on Trek.fm, The Ready Room.
You don't create a better future and then it's just there and it's just stagnant and nothing ever threatens it, right? That's not reality.
Yeah, you'd end up with Star Trek The Next Generation if you did that, right? No,
right, well, exactly. And I think that's why a lot of people who love The Next Generation don't like Deep Space Nine, because Deep Space Nine challenges that premise.
To the journey!
You say, this is what you're going to do. You're not going to film Star Trek Nemesis, that piece of crap TNG movie. You're not going to do it. You're going to make Voyager... The movie that you film is going to be a 2.5-hour extravaganza that really shows the struggle with the Borg instead of making it look like you beat the Borg in 1 second, you know?
Melodic Treks.
This may be the only time we get to do something, and we have to make sure it's as good as it gets. That we try and put on all the great moments.
Continuing mission.
I would do a new issue and I would print them out and then staple them together, and it would have weight and it would land on the table with a thump. And I was like, wow, all of that, I did this.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all of these episodes and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe. You can find us everywhere that you get your podcasts. Of course, we're in iTunes, where we're a featured content provider. You can find our artist page at itunes.com/TrekFM. And we really thank Apple for doing that for us. It's wonderful to be a featured content provider there in the iTunes store. If you're not an Apple user, there are many other ways you can get our shows. You can find us on Stitcher, TuneIn, Windows Phone, BlackBerry, SoundCloud. We're also now on Google Play Music, which I'm very happy about. It makes it a lot easier for our Android listeners to get the show. So if you are an Android user and you've been jumping through hoops to get your podcasts, get your Google Play Music app out, search for The Orb, search for Trek FM, and we should come up, and now you can listen to us right there. Now, you can also always go to our website. We have a show page for every episode. You can stream from that page. You can also download the MP3 file, and you can grab the RSS link if you want to pop that into some other app or tool that you use to listen to audio. If you'd like to share your feedback on today's show, there are many ways that you can do that. Probably the best way to do it, if you want to join in the discussion that follows the show, is in the Babel Conference on Facebook. Matthew, tell everyone a little bit about that.
Well, the Babel Conference is our listeners-only discussion group. You can find that on Facebook. That if you go to Facebook, just type in the search field, The Babel Conference, and we'll pull up. Or if you're on our website at trek.fm, you can click discussion on any of the menu bars on any of the show pages, and that'll bring you to the Babel Conference as well. Just ask to be let in, and we'll let you in. Now, it is a closed group, and so you do have to be approved to be let in, but we'll let you in, and that way you can get the opportunity to talk to everybody that's out there listening to the shows and talking about what we're talking about on all the different shows. I mean, we have so many shows, Chris, so many people talking about things. It's a lot of fun, so everybody come and join.
Yeah, we keep it closed because we want it to be for listeners. We don't want just every random person on Facebook coming in who knows nothing about our podcasts. So being approved just means that you know to go there and you click join. And then we will let you in. And yeah, we have so many shows. We publish 3 to 4 podcasts per day on the network. So there is new Star Trek talk for you every day of the week. So go and check it out. I also want to take a quick moment and thank our associate producers here on The Orb, Ruth Ward, Will Wynn, and Ken Tripp. Thank you so much, Ruth, Will, and Ken, for helping us get the show out to everyone every time. And if you'd like to become an associate producer, you can do that as well through Patreon. Just go to patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm to find out how you can become part of the team, support the network. We are listener supported. It costs quite a lot of money to operate the network and to get these shows out to everyone. And we could really use your help. So go check it out, patreon.com/trekfm. Now, we mentioned the Babel Conference. There are other ways for you to get in touch with us if you're not on Facebook. If you're on Twitter, our username is TrekFM. You can also send us an email if you go to trek.fm/contact and use the form that you find there. Just choose to send to a show and choose The Orb, and that'll come to both Matthew and me by email. And you can also send us a voice message if you go to speakpipe.com/TrekFM. That's the word speak and the word pipe together, .com/TrekFM. Now, Matthew, when you're not reading Chapter 7 of How to Pick Up a Solid, where can people find you?
Well, Chris, you can find me on Twitter. I tweet about that. You can also find me doing literary treks here on the network with Dan, talking about the books and the comics of Star Trek, which is so much fun. We also interview the authors. We just recently had Dayton Ward talking about his brand new book. So that's just check it out. It's a blast. I also do our general geek show here on the network. Now, we love Star Trek, but we've got to have a place to sit back and talk about other things, other fandoms. So head on over to the 602 Club. That's the best place to do that here on the network. We have a great time talking about all the other fandoms we love. It's so much fun. I hope you will join us there. And of course, I do a smaller podcast with my good friend John Mills. It's called Aggressive Negotiations. You can find us on iTunes under Aggressive Negotiations, and it's all about different things in Star Wars that we feel like talking about that week. So Now, Chris, when you're not defying your Cardassian father to, you know, be with that wonderful Bajoran woman, where can we find you?
How did you know? Is it the ridges on my forehead? How did you know about my Cardassian father?
Yeah.
Well, you can find me elsewhere on the network doing The Ready Room, where we talk about all five live-action Star Trek series, and also from time to time, Hyper Channel, our short news show. You can find me on Twitter. My username is C. Brian Jones, letter C and Brian with a Y. That's also my username pretty much everywhere in social media. And you'll find me there in the Babel Conference, also talking Star Trek with all of our wonderful listeners. If you want to read my writing about Star Trek, you can find that over on the official website at startrek.com. And then otherwise, yeah, you know, Twitter's probably the best place to catch me because it's quick and easy, and I do tweet a fair bit.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, and we will see you next time as we gaze into the orb.